I'm Spencer Beckwith for KUNM. In the early years, rock and roll posters were pretty basic. Large, legible print, studio photos of the performers, and one or two primary colors as accent. In the 1960s, responding to changes in music and society, there was an explosion of new ideas about what a rock poster could be. An outstanding collection of 1960s rock posters is now on view at the Albuquerque Museum. And with me is Titus O'Brien, the exhibit's curator and author of the accompanying book from UNM Press. Titus, welcome.
Thank you very much, Spencer.
You point out in the book that the wild new look of these posters was directly related to the popularity of psychedelic drugs.
Right. You know, this plethora of influences is directly tied to the effects of these substances. We understand this as a physiological reality now. Under the influence of psychedelic substances of various kinds, the brain lights up, more of the brain lights up, and it does so in unusual ways. So different parts of the brain are talking to each other, more parts of the brain are activated. And so these drugs just blew the doors off. And they were inspired to start putting things together in unexpected ways.
And it's not just that the artists were influenced by their experiences with psychedelic drugs, but it's almost as if they are trying to induce in the viewer an experience of being on a psychedelic drug trip.
A contact high, if you will. And they were producing work for their confederates. This was a quite organic phenomena. It started with a few handbills, like hand-drawn handbills, and then this scene exploded so fast. So really, from start to finish, but we're talking about a 5-year or so period, maybe even shorter, maybe really a 3-year peak. And, you know, all of these people knew each other, and they were competing with each other. They were inspired by each other. It was just a very vibrant time. So there was a lot going on, and this visual component has surprisingly turned out to be, in some ways, one of the most enduring.
And you make the point in the book that the changes to commercial production that started with these posters still very much with us today.
Absolutely. And one image that I include in the book is of a La Cumbre brewery label, which I learned that the artist was himself directly inspired by the psychedelic 60s artist, but that was obvious in his work. So, yeah, it's everywhere.
One thing that I've always wondered about is the influence, artistic influence, on these posters. You make a point that there are so many artistic influences that is an influence itself.
My favorite line in the book, it's a couple of $50 words. I say that psychedelia is properly defined by its contumacious heterogeneity, which is a fancy way to say that, you know, they threw in everything in the kitchen sink. Often the Art Nouveau influences, the Jungenstil, the Vienna Secession, these are turn of the century, early modern art movements that tend to be kind of floral, highly romantic. So the psychedelic 60s are definitely defined by a high degree of romanticism. But what I really wanted to underscore and allude to is everything else is in there too. Sci-fi, every kind of strand of modernism is evident, but also you have the influence of Asian art, calligraphy, Middle Eastern calligraphy. It's all in there.
And Old West, 19th century Old West.
That's a huge influence. That actually is really, in some ways, the bedrock or the foundation, because there was a band, a little known band today called the Charlatans, who really contributed heavily to the emerging psychedelic style, but their whole trip was to kind of push against the Beatles and the British invasion to posit an American style. And so being Californians, they looked to sort of Gold Rush era, Old West stuff. So they tricked themselves out and wore, you know, Old West garb and Victoriana, and they crafted their own poster. This is really interesting. It was 2 years before the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper. The Charlatans were doing the same thing. They were wearing costumes, period costumes, crafting personas, and then permeating that through their entire output, be it visual and musical.
One of the things people will notice first about these posters is the lack of legibility in the type. Sometimes you cannot read at all what they are supposedly advertising. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from?
Rebellion. That's, of course, the generational buzzword. That was the entire modus of the era. It was rebellion. So you had an artist like Victor Moscoso. Victor Moscoso was born in Spain, grew up in Brooklyn. He was very well trained. He went to Cooper Union, got a degree at Yale, where he studied with Joseph Albers, who was one of the founders of the Bauhaus. So we're talking Mr. Modernism, Joseph Albers. His theories of color were very influential, and he taught his students not to put complementary colors, we would call them, orange and violet, next to each other, because they create disharmonious effects. So once he got out of Albers' orbit, Moscoso did basically just that. I think a little bit under the influence of some of these substances, by his own admission. So these disharmonious but quite exciting color combinations combined with imagery. And then all of these artists started pushing into weird territory with the fonts, really manipulating lettering. Modern design was absolutely defined by clarity. Mies van der Rohe, the well-known architect and kind of modern sophist, one of the great philosophical thinkers of the modernist movements, he, of course, famously said, less is more. Later, I can't remember exactly who said less is a bore, but that was certainly the psychedelic philosophy. Pack as much as you can into it and make it as compelling and interesting to look at. That was, of course, put to the fore, and what was put in the back seat was appealing to corporate clients, to making it easy for the viewer.
Even though these artists acknowledged that they were advertising something, they were simultaneously contemptuous of the idea of advertising.
Absolutely, yeah. They really embodied that ambiguity.
Do you, Titus, have a particular poster or a particular artist you really grew to love?
When I was working as assistant curator at the Albuquerque Museum, a retired doctor named James Gunn came into the museum basically pleading with us to take his incredible collection of posters because he was concerned that something might happen to him or to the posters and they might get damaged or dispersed. And he really didn't want to see his collection divvied up. So we accepted his very generous gift. And then I began the process of sorting these nearly 300 objects. And while I recognized a lot of the images, Spencer, as you discussed, you had an older brother who had a lot of these posters, and I had an older sister who likewise had some of these posters and had passed along a lot of 45 records down to me. You know, I kind of got schooled in the era through the atmosphere. And while I recognized a lot of the posters, I didn't necessarily know all the granular details. But the artist that I most responded to right off the bat was Victor Moscoso. There's a particular poster, it's a Doors poster, that I say in the book is kind of a combination of like Sergio Leone and James Bond pushed through the psychedelic looking glass. I mean, it's just really wonderful and trippy, and it's just got all the elements, everything great. I think it's a pinnacle of 60s design.
What about an object in the exhibit or an object in the book that you think represents what these artists were really about and really trying to do?
Well, there's a particular poster by Wes Wilson. Now, Wes Wilson was really the progenitor. He's the godfather of the entire scene. He was first and foremost, and everybody acknowledges that they were inspired by him and responding to what he was doing. And he was doing a whole series that were really pushing the font experiments. in crazy directions. And so there's one, it's a really sort of lurid green and red combination where it looks like all the lettering is on fire, is in flames, and it really is difficult to read. And it really pushed all the artists to begin to compete. And they acknowledged this, that they began to compete with each other on how difficult they could make posters to read. So we have Wes Wilson to really thank for that.
Wes Wilson. You mentioned the collection that this exhibit and the book based on. They are in pristine condition. This collector was, from the very beginning, saving these as works of art.
He was. And it's an interesting story that I think, again, is very typical for the time period. But he was a student at Berkeley, and so he was collecting posters. You know, he kept a few, but in the decades following the 1960s, he began to collect. You know, there were sources for these posters, which had been, in many cases, produced in great quantities. And so there were still sources of these posters left. So he continued to kind of seek out and really put together a beautiful, he demonstrated a lot of connoisseurship. So when I started to put this book together and the show, there were very few things that I needed to consider borrowing. So there were a few key pieces to tell the story, but in terms of the most beautiful posters, Dr. Gunn definitely acquired those.
Right. And a diverse collection.
Very diverse.
As you said. Many of us, Titus, look to these posters as a source of nostalgia. What can you suggest to us about a way to look at them and see them in a different way?
I think to really analyze the visuals. I saw an opportunity here to really treat this material as art first and foremost and not as artifact. I've tried to set it up so that you've got counterpoints. So there's strong pop art influences in some of the posters. So I included an Andy Warhol. There's strong calligraphic, Asian and Arabic calligraphic influences. So we've included some of those. So there's some thematic issues that can be used, hopefully, to get under the skin of the posters and get past the pure nostalgia so that we can get some fresh kind of insight. And as I also say in the book, you know, these posters are important as artifacts of the era, but I think the most important thing is to try to understand how they're still informing our culture today, a culture in which I think at latest count, 36 states have some form of legal cannabis. Denver just decriminalized magic mushrooms. We've got a lot of scientific studies, again, looking into the potential therapeutic benefits of psychedelic substances, including at UNM. So I think it's a really wonderful opportunity to sort of reflect on our own lives and our own time and not just what came before, but what's happening now. And I think it's also really important to be aware of the shadows. There's, you know, rainbows and unicorns literally everywhere these days, and maybe we can credit the 60s to that. But we also have drug epidemic problems. We've got, you know, conflict right now and inequality, massive homelessness problem. So these issues, a lot of these things have their roots in the 60s, both good and bad. So I think this is a fresh and interesting way, and I think this art is often this, should serve as this, as a way that, again, just like in the posters, all the influences and all the effects and all the ideas are present in an art object in a way that they aren't in necessarily in a podcast or an essay or a political speech. An art object can sort of concretize all of this stuff, and you can get the philosophy, you can get religion, you get eros and logos, the whole spectrum.
And also a sense of what people were feeling like and thinking at the time when these objects were being made.
And doing so under the influence of panoply of substances. And it's interesting to note, too, that a lot of the artists weren't necessarily big fans of the music that they were creating posters for. And some of them weren't even really taking the drugs either. They were just artists responding to the artistic influences. In fact, this period was so fecund. There were so many things going on. These artists were extremely busy. They were working around the clock and they had hard deadlines. And they were working, in most cases, with journeyman print shops and printmakers who were highly skilled and had, you know, been in the business for decades in some cases. So they had this really interesting experience of encountering these artists, and then the artists had to sort of match their technical requirements. And so all these interesting collaborations emerged out of that.
And I would also imagine that they would have to produce a lot more posters than they might have ordinarily, because people were probably stealing them.
It began that way. There were two primary producers. There was Bill Graham, and then there was Family Dog Productions, which was helmed, pun intended, by Chet Helms. And those two guys really set the scene. And they started out producing, you know, a couple hundred posters for a show. But these posters became so popular so instantly. You had all these young people who were looking for ways to decorate their dorm walls, their Haight-Ashbury apartments. They wanted to show their membership in this new culture. You know, there were all kinds of ways to show your bona fides. So the posters were just getting ripped down left and right. So they started producing more and more and more. So within a couple of years, Bill Graham was producing upwards of 100,000 posters per week. And these were being sold in shops devoted. In many cases, they were first head shops. So they were selling everything from clothing to smoking paraphernalia to posters. But there were specific stores that emerged to just sell the posters themselves. And there was a very important art exhibit in a sort of mainstream upper crust art gallery in San Francisco in 1967 called The Joint Show, which featured what are called the Big Five artists: Moscoso and Wilson, Rick Griffin, Mouse, Alton Kelly. So they had this kind of recognition almost from the start. Wes Wilson received a National Endowment for the Arts grant that he used to get out of San Francisco as the scene was kind of imploding. It was becoming too commercial for his taste. So he actually bought a farm and moved his family, his young family, out to this farm. And he's basically been more of a farmer than an artist ever since.
And very few of these artists are really still producing art.
Well, it's kind of come and gone. A lot of them fell away. But as happens, interest has grown. And so now a lot of them have returned to making art quite successfully. And there are conferences devoted to the posters. You know, aficionados gather. And it's, you know, it's like Comic-Con at a much smaller scale for the poster artists.
No cosplay.
Not as far as I know. Yeah.
Titus O'Brien has curated Dreams Unreal, an exhibit of psychedelic rock posters from the 60s on view at the Albuquerque Museum through April 12th. He's also responsible for the accompanying book from UNM Press. Titus, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Spencer. That was great.
For KUNM, I'm Spencer Beckwith.